It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. Stay ahead of all the big games in the best league in the world, the Premier League. With the latest odds, form guides, expert opinions and more, the fans are the players at Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com, 18 plus, begambleaware.org. T's and C's apply.
Hello and welcome to Premier League All Access with me, Sam Matterface, TalkSport's chief football correspondent, Alex Crook, and we've got international football expert Kevin Hatchard here as well. Here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Comes out to Cullen. Now Goodmanson! Oh, within 10 seconds of coming on! He's got a fourth for Burnley.
Luton 1, Brentford 5. The narrative beforehand was if Luton won, they could climb out of the bottom three. The narrative at the end is they look doomed now, possibly to go down. And Brentford are pretty much saved.
Doku in towards De Bruyne. Pulls it through the area. Bernardo Silva is at the back post. And he doesn't miss this time. But Manchester City have bounced back from shootout shock to knock Chelsea out of the FA Cup and revive their hopes of a double.
Kai Havertz onto Martin Ødegaard, cuts it back, it's blocked. Ødegaard again, scores. The captain finishes it off, and Arsenal are back on top of the Premier League table.
Palace 5, West Ham 2, a scoreline that basically does West Ham no favours. Their European hopes are now all but over.
Everton 2, Nottingham Forest 0. This was as nervy and mistake-ridden a game as we expected. Bags of controversy and Beto of Everton stretched off at the end.
It's finished here, Fulham 1, Liverpool 3. And it's a win that shows that Liverpool will not throw the towel in on their title challenge yet.
Boylan scores this, United have won! And the roar tells you that it is an all-Manchester FA Cup final.
Hello, gentlemen. Now, look, I don't want to lay the law down here, but I'm going to have to make some rules. And if you don't abide by them, I will make a decision, and that decision is final. What I don't want you to do is get the hump, go on Twitter, and start complaining about it. And we all agree that that's going to be a little bit of decorum that we're going to instill in the pod.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair.
Do I just check that none of you have been...
No insinuations of corruption or anything like that.
No, and none of you have employed a rules analyst just in case to be your mouthpiece. And nobody gave anyone's owners the login to their social media. Just checking. What a week it has been. What a weekend it has been. Crook and I were at Wembley both days. Kev was watching the Premier League action from elsewhere. Usually at this point, we have like a little conversation about what everyone's been up to, but there's just so much to get our teeth into. So let's get straight into the FA Cup semi-finals.
Doku towards De Bruyne, pulls it through the area. Bernardo Silva is at the back post and he doesn't miss this time. But Manchester City have bounced back from shootout shock to knock Chelsea out of the FA Cup and revive their hopes of a double.
I've gone on about it, but you cannot begin to imagine how difficult physically that was, what they went through midweek and how tired they must have been.
If you take it back last season, obviously winning the treble and playing a lot of football, they've never really set the heights and the standards we know.
Boylan scores this, United have won! Yeah! And the roar tells you that it is an all-Manchester FA Cup final.
I've got to say, Coventry hit the underside of the bar in extra time, their chances where they burst into the box with Casemiro and Maguire at their mercy where maybe they could have won it, but it was just brilliant. Honestly, what a spectacle.
And it's a repeat of last year's Manchester Derby FA Cup final. Never, ever doubt the FA Cup. This is why we love it on TalkSport.
Coventry City 3, Manchester United 3. Let's look at some of the back pages that are doing the rounds as a result of that performance by Manchester United. Lucky Devils on the back page of The Sun. Ten Hag, we got away with it, but I'm not embarrassed. In brackets, really, Eric? Question mark. Ten Hag's Man United are inept and chaotic. Ratcliffe must put him out of his misery. Oliver Brown in the Telegraph. Manchester United were humiliated in victory, and Anthony's awful celebration sums it up, Jason Burt. And in the Manchester Evening News, Eric Ten Hag should know his Manchester United fate after seeing Sir Jim Ratcliffe on the big screen. So where do you want to start, Alex Crook? Because I heard, and maybe I am jumping the gun here a little bit, that you tried to walk out a couple of times and were held back by your children.
That sums it up quite nicely, doesn't it? That's right. If it wasn't for the fact I had the three kids in tow, big family day out, first time they'd seen United at Wembley, I would have walked out at the end of normal time. I was so angry. I just sat there watching extra time with a face like thunder. My daughter had to keep saying to me, "Dad, you're going to give yourself frown lines. You're going to give yourself grey hairs. We need some positivity here." I was absolutely raging. And you know what? I wasn't alone. The atmosphere in the Manchester United end of the ground was toxic throughout extra time. We could not believe what we were watching. A team of professional players against a side from a lower division with the game in the palm of their hands with 19 minutes left on the clock, a 3-0 lead. To throw that away and to capitulate and crumble in the manner they did was absolutely shameful. And that headline in the Telegraph, I think you said, summed it up really. If it's possible to be embarrassed and humiliated in victory, United managed to achieve that yesterday. Ten Hag is partially to blame for his substitutions. The Garnacho one made no sense at all. He wasn't tired. If anything, United looked far more leggy when he wasn't on the pitch. Kobbie Mainoo is a teenager. He doesn't need a rest. He brought on Christian Eriksen, who just doesn't have the legs to get around a big pitch like Wembley anymore. That was a bad substitution. But take that away from it. As soon as they conceded the first goal, the body language, or lack of, from the United players was unacceptable. And there were no leaders on that pitch. And they should be embarrassed to even contemplate celebrating and doing what Anthony did to those Coventry players. Because I tell you what, he produced an abysmal performance when he came on. Does that cover it?
But you covered quite a lot there. I'm taking it from the tone of your conversation that you don't buy into the narrative that this was an FA Cup fairy tale in the making. However, Coventry did play their part and deserve a lot of credit for it. And I think, I know we're doing Premier League or access here, so most of the people that listen to this are more interested in Manchester United and their plight rather than Coventry City and the way they constructed that comeback. But I think Mark Robbins deserves a hell of a lot of credit for the way he altered the team in the second half. He changed formation at half time. He then made two or three really good substitutions. Sheaf was excellent in the game, absolutely superb. Torp came on, made a massive impact on the direction of the match. So I think he deserves a lot of credit. And actually, one of the complaints I think Manchester United fans have had about Eric Ten Hag, and let's not make any bones about it, there's a lot of injuries at Old Trafford, so I can understand that his squad was limited, but the impact from the bench was largely negative one, Kevin, from Eric Ten Hag and Manchester United, whereas Mark Robbins definitely did influence the game in a positive way. And that, for the powers that be that were watching it, will be head-scratching.
Yeah, I think it's really alarming. And I think this is the culmination of something we've talked about for weeks, actually, which is this game management and this lack of structure. Because what you end up with is a team, and Coventry were brilliant in the way that they came back. You're absolutely right. I thought Ellis Sims was fantastic. I'm amazed about Hadji Wright, because I used to commentate on him when he was at Schalke. There was no indication that he'd be able to develop into the player that he's become. And the way he took that penalty, I thought, was utterly sensational. Under the most unbearable pressure. So well done to him. But you get the sense that it kind of doesn't matter who the opponents are in a way. You look at the number of shots Newport racked up earlier in the competition. It doesn't really matter who they play. The way they approach games, the way that they give up chances, the way that there's no real structure to the team, that then allows anybody in. And I thought Coventry took a full advantage of that. But also, there's an older problem here. If you think about what we talked about under Solskjaer, if we thought, even go back to Mourinho, we talked about body language, a lack of leadership. We talked about a team that falls apart all too often. So, yeah, they might change Ten Hag in the summer, and there'd be absolutely evidence to suggest that's the right thing to do. Are you changing the culture enough? Are you putting in that leadership? So it's going to have to be a mix of things, because they're deep-rooted, these problems, because most top teams in the Premier League, I would say, would have seen that out comfortably because they'd have the game management to do it. And United just don't have that.
Well, look, they were 3-0 up. It was probably one of their most professional performances of the season so far at 3-0. After 60 minutes, you were just thinking to yourself, this is done, this is dusted, this is finished. In fact, when the third goal went in, I think I said, that's it. You know, they're through. Wembley way will be Mancunian way when it comes to the FA Cup final at the end of May. Because it seemed inevitable at that stage. But this is the problem with Manchester United, isn't it? It's their ability to collapse at a moment's notice. And you talk about things have got to change. We know that they are changing. Jason Wilcox was there yesterday. He's the new technical director. Dan Ashworth will be in situ in the not too distant future. Whether he's in time to help influence what happens in the summer or not remains to be seen. But there is obviously a clear shift behind the scenes. But I think yesterday just underscored that Erik ten Hag is not the man to take this club forward. And I think every single message that I got from Manchester United fans, friends of mine, close family who are Manchester United fans, towards the end of that game, I looked at my phone at full time, was saying, I hope we lose because we don't deserve to go through after that. After capitulating in that manner, I mean, there was a lot of swear words as well. Some of them were from Crook. Yes, it's true. I hope we lose was a common theme because people, I think, are fed up with the overall attitude of the way that the Manchester United players behave in the matches. You mentioned the Garnacho substitution, Crook. When he came off, he was bemused as to why his number was the one that was shown. Were you bemused as to why his number was shown? Because I think he is probably Manchester United's best weapon in transition. He's fast. He carries the ball brilliantly. He's capable of a big moment. He's not perfect. He's still a kid. But he was definitely more effective than Rashford on the other side, who seemed to continue to dribble into cul-de-sacs.
Well, they say the sign of madness is if you keep making the same mistakes over and over again. And Garnacho gets taken off at the end of most matches. And there's a common theme here. He got taken off at the end of the Chelsea game when they were in a position of control. They didn't win. They lost that match. He was taken off against Liverpool. They ended up conceding a late equaliser in that game. And obviously, they've ended up conceding three goals in this one. So you'd think Ten Hag should have learned his lesson. Marcus Rashford is a massive problem. Marcus Rashford has been a massive problem for Erik ten Hag throughout the course of the season, with his conduct off the pitch, with his lack of performances and seemingly his lack of effort on the pitch. He was booed off by most of the people in the Manchester United end of Wembley yesterday. That relationship between player and support base seems broken, and he doesn't seem capable of doing anything to repair that. I think Ten Hag could do himself a big favour in the final few games of the season and just take Rashford out of the team altogether. He is offering nothing, and if you're Garnacho and you're playing your heart out on one wing and you look across to the other side of the pitch and you see a guy producing such a lack of effort, you're going to be perplexed. It's going to cause problems in the dressing room as well, I'm sure.
Kevin, I wonder what the nature of the game says about the way that English football is going. Because one of the things I said to Dicko as we came off the gantry yesterday, and Guy Mowbray and I were having a chat on the way down as well, I said to them, we spent 25 years eulogising, reminiscing about Newcastle and Liverpool's 4-3 games like they were standout moments in Premier League history. We are having games like that almost on a weekly basis at this moment in time. Why is that?
I think certainly if you listen to ex-pros, they'll tell you repeatedly that defending isn't as highly prized as it used to be. And also the way the rules have changed to protect players. You can't be as physical as you used to be. You can't put in those reducers, if you like, that you used to. I think that's a good thing because you want to protect players. You want to see flair players be able to thrive and not be kicked from pillar to post the whole way through. But look at the teams that are really effective. Look at two of the three teams in the Premier League title race. They're all about control. So you've got Arsenal, You've got Manchester City, you've got Guardiola and Arteta, who are very, very similar in their approach. Of course, they worked together for a long, long time. And it's all about trying to reduce those intangibles, trying to make sure you can control everything. But it takes a hell of a lot of coaching to do that. And it takes a hell of a lot of discipline to do that. And a lot of teams just simply don't have it. Liverpool do it in a different way. They use chaos as their greatest weapon and it really works for them.
Yeah.
But it demands a hell of a lot of intensity from the players. I think we've seen that in a few recent games that you can't hit that level every time. You're not going to be able to be anywhere near as effective. But I do think the standard of defending has generally dropped.
Where do Manchester United go from here? Because they do have an FA Cup final to look forward to against Manchester City. I say look forward to. Do you look forward to an FA Cup final with Manchester City? Or do you just absolutely cack yourself?
I think I feel quite vanilla about the whole thing, to be honest. And I guess that's the most damning indictment of all. I'm not excited particularly because I think we know the outcome. Am I fearful? No, because again, it's inevitable. Anything other than a Manchester City win is a bonus. And again, that's probably a pretty poor reflection of where United are as a football club. Do I trust this group of players to galvanise themselves and raise themselves enough to overturn City at Wembley? No. Do I trust this manager to come up with a tactical masterclass to get the better of Pep Guardiola? No. So unless something ridiculous happens, City are going to retain the cup?
Well, things that are ridiculous do happen, and they happen quite a lot in English football. So you never know. Manchester United fans, do not lose hope. It is just like them to pull something out of the fire. And you never know, Manchester City might well be tired, as they were on Saturday when they beat Chelsea by 1-0. And as Alex Crook will tell you, it doesn't matter how bad Manchester United are. Whenever they have a bad day, Chelsea always seem to have a worse one, just to make him feel that tiny bit better. And it was a late Bernardo Silva goal that sealed the deal for Manchester City, who were not the best team across this football match. Actually, Chelsea created a hell of a lot more chances and should have won the game. But Kevin Hatchard, Nicholas Jackson couldn't finish his dinner on Saturday night, could he?
No, he couldn't. And that's been a running theme. He's a really curious player because you look at his numbers. You know, he's into double figures now in the Premier League. He came to Chelsea with only really half a season of top quality performances behind him because he had that run with Villarreal where he was bashing in goals in La Liga, left, right and centre. To bring him in was always a risk. To bring him in and having Nkunku injured all season is unfortunate because it means that they've really relied upon him to play a lot of games, a lot of high-pressure games. And his finishing is ragged. There's absolutely no doubt about it. He gives you a lot in terms of his movement, in terms of his pace, but he's immature. We saw that from that disgraceful penalty incident the other night against Everton where he was trying to take the penalty.
Haircut
I thought
choice.
He should have been substituted. Well, there is that. Should have been substituted immediately. And so should Madueke. I thought that was weak management, actually, by Mauricio Pochettino. They were well up in the game. Should have taken them off immediately. So look, he's raw. Of course he is. He's hugely inexperienced. And in these big games, are we asking a lot for him to be hugely clinical at this stage? Some strikers never learn to do that. So we'll see with him. So I'm a little reticent to blame him in the way that I would maybe blame a 27-year-old or 28-year-old.
Yeah.
And I know people will say, well, hang on, Cole Palmer scores goals. He's ice cool. Cole Palmer's Cole Palmer.
Yeah.
He's a completely different class of player. So I think, yes, he should be more clinical, but I can understand why he's not.
I can understand why he's not because we've seen it over the course of the season. But I think in those circumstances, you've got to score at least one of those chances. And it's decision-making, not just from him, and he was guilty of it, but other players were guilty of it too in that game. Moises Caicedo gets a good chance. He makes the wrong decision. Ben Chilwell right at the very end can play the ball in behind the City defence. Raheem Sterling's running through clear. He doesn't play the ball. By the time he plays the ball, there's a defender there to block it and it goes out for a corner. They win a free kick in injury time. Mykhailo Mudryk takes it. Who made that decision? Because he just ballooned the ball into the supporters behind the goal. I mean, it was just a bad decision-making for Chelsea. And Crook, you were sitting in front of the Chelsea fans. I think for most of that game, or about for 50 minutes, they thought, we can do this. But when it got to sort of, I think that double chance from Jackson that didn't go in, they lost a little bit of belief that they were going to, and it almost felt inevitable that City were going to come back and score.
Yeah, I think if Chelsea had scored one of those chances, I don't think City physically would have had the capability to necessarily come back into the game. I think that the second of the double chance that Jackson had, the header, he just wasn't anticipating it. I was right in line with that. He wasn't expecting it to come to him, and that probably tells you why he's not a top-level centre-forward at this moment in time. I also think that Pep Guardiola's substitutions were more effective than Pochettino's. I think Doku off the bench made a real difference on that left-hand side. And
yeah,
Pochettino tried to change his back line to cope with that, and it just didn't work. So in the end, I think you have to praise Manchester City for their mentality, because it was character and mentality that got them over the line, as opposed to footballing ability. In fact, it was probably one of their worst footballing performances of the season. But it does come back to the League Cup final as well, when Liverpool looked there for the taking and Chelsea wilted in extra time. And I guess if you're a Pochettino detractor, and I'm not necessarily one of those, as you know, but you'll point to his record in big games, and this will be another stick to beat him with, because Chelsea should have gone through, no question about that, and they won't get a better opportunity.
I actually don't think you can beat Poch with a stick over the head because of this performance, because he constructed a team that should have won the game, right? So they had the big chances, and he can't put the ball in the back of the net. And that's been mainly the criticism of Chelsea over the course of the season. If you look at their expected goals total and the big chances created over the course of the campaign, they'd be much higher in the table, and they probably would have won two cups. You know, it's crazy. They've had enough chances to do all of these things. The issues that they've had is that they do switch off defensively. There's a huge amount of immaturity, and it's bad decision making in the final third, which has cost them over the course of the season. Interestingly, Crook has just raised the point of the substitutions and how they didn't influence the game in Chelsea's favour, and that Pep's certainly did. Doku, for example, brilliant scouting, excellent player, great carrying the ball, unsettles every defender he comes up against, no doubt. Actually, De Sassi, when he came on, did okay against him. He had one moment which didn't go his way, but he did okay. Gusto was struggling with him, big style. However, you look at that Chelsea bench, and I imagine that Mauricio Pochettino thinks, well, there's not much I can do there. And that's quite an indictment, bearing in mind that Chelsea has spent all that money, Kevin. I know that, again, you know, there's a raft and raft of injuries, but actually they've thrown away so much experience, sold so much experience, and they've bought in a lot of young players and players that actually haven't cut it. Like, I mean, Sterling, obviously a great player for England, great history, but actually hasn't done enough for his transfer value at Chelsea. And when you look over the bench and he's your option, actually he's been injured, he hasn't played particularly well recently, you know, he's not going to change things, is it?
No, and it's the product of the muddled thinking since the takeover, because they went with more experienced players to start with. You know, Koulibaly came in, Sterling came in, then they pivoted to this policy of getting as many top young talents as they possibly could, throwing them together. And you're kind of seeing a team that's trying to learn on the fly and trying to develop on the fly. And I do think Pochettino, you know, you listen to the way he talks, and he talks about, well, we're going to assess things in the summer. He clearly wants to make changes.
Yeah.
But how many changes are Chelsea really going to be able to make in the summer because of PSR? I know they keep saying we're within PSR, it's not a problem. But you can't spend the money that they've spent, you know, and still have a load of wriggle room in the transfer market. I think they're unfortunate, because I genuinely think if they'd had Nkunku available for more games this season, that would have made a difference. Those XG figures you're talking about would be different, because he's a hell of a finisher. And I think if he'd had some of the chances Jackson has had, Chelsea would be in a different position, I think. The other thing, I've seen a lot of Chelsea recently. I do feel like something's happening there that's positive. I do feel the team has a little bit more structure. I do feel like Palmer is such an important player for them. The thing they've actually got to guard against with Palmer, I think, is it can't all be about him.
Yeah.
And it speaks a lot to his character that he really wants to take all of that on his shoulders. Yeah, he wants to take all of that on his shoulders. 50%
of all of their goals come either from his boots or he assists them. 50% of all of their goals, and that is a concern, right? Okay, you want a player who's going to influence positively, but you don't want someone who is the only one who's influencing positively, and that's the danger. That is the danger.
Yeah, exactly.
I did think that, you know, you suggesting that Chelsea keep coming out and saying they're within PSR, it's a little bit like Erik ten Hag keep coming out and saying our style is clearly definable, isn't it? I mean, Neither are true. Right, okay, let's get to the Premier League. And I'm going to get in trouble for this, right? But I'm going off-piste. I was supposed to go and talk about the leaders, Arsenal, next. But I can't because Mark Clattenburg is going to write a column about me if I don't address the big issues of the day. Let's talk Nottingham Forest.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. There's a lot more to those 90 minutes than what goes down on the pitch. With the latest odds, form guides and expert opinions, you'll know the score with Ladbrokes. Odds update on Talk Sport with Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com, 18 plus, begambleaware.org, T's and C's apply.
Everton 2, Nottingham Forest 0, VAR corruption. Nottingham Forest releasing a statement on X straight after the game against Everton where they believe they should have had three penalties. Three extremely poor decisions. Three penalties not given, which we simply cannot expect. I don't know who wrote this, by the way, because the punctuation is terrible. We warned the PGMOL that the VAR is a Luton fan. That's quite a big accusation before the game. But they didn't change him. Our patience has been tested multiple times. NFFC will now consider its options. What those options are, I don't know. Maybe they're thinking about taking legal action. I don't know. But either way, it seemed like a nuclear option to release such a statement. I don't know why I've read it to you, because you've probably seen it by now. It's been viewed about 400 million times on Twitter or X or whatever it is you call it nowadays. But Crook, this is actually, joking aside, and we will joke about it, because one of the things that Nottingham Forest have done here is although they've highlighted three problems, and I, you know, they probably could have had two penalties out of the three, probably, on another day, is that they've lost the public opinion. They've lost the sort of public will, the goodwill that comes with these bad decisions. When you get a bad decision, most people go, oh, poor Nottingham Forest getting these bad decisions. But because they've gone about it in this manner, actually people have gone, all right, chill out. That's just a bit over the top. Because they've called into the question the integrity of Stuart Atwell.
Yeah, and I think, listen, there's reason to be unhappy with some of the decisions, not just on Sunday, but over the course of the season that have gone against Forest. I think it's similar to how Gary O'Neill has felt about Wolverhampton Wanderers at points this campaign. But I think the wording of the statement is very dangerous. And when you suggest that the reason that VAR, in their eyes, have not done their job properly is because they have a vested interest because they're a Luton Town fan, I mean, that's libelous. There's no question about that. You're questioning the integrity of Stuart Atwell. You're questioning the integrity of the professional game and match officials, and you're accusing them of corruption. They're not corrupt. They might be not very good at times. I think we've all had cause to complain about the standards of officiating, the way the technology is used, but that's very different from corruption. So I hope that the FA hit Forest very hard in the pocket. I'm sure a big fine is coming their way. I'm told that the tweet came almost directly from Marinakis, and probably even their own comms team were a bit embarrassed to tweet it. I think they brought shame upon the football club. I really do.
Listen, we've all studied libel law because of our jobs. The fact that they have pretty clearly identified the person in charge, because they've said the VAR, so that is Stuart Atwell, right? They've said that he is a Luton fan. Information, by the way, that he may not want everybody to know, and one of those things that, you know, might be out there in circles, but not something that he wants people to know. But suggesting that they asked him to be changed was, and that being the reason, suggested, as Crook said, that he was corruptible. I mean, he could sue them for that, right? He could suggest that they are implying that he can't do his job properly, so therefore he could take legal action against them for that. It's a very strange thing for a football club to do, especially bearing in mind that I think they employed Mark Clattenburg to come out and say this stuff for them from a position of strength, rather than Nuno Espirito Santo or Marinakis coming out and saying it himself. I just don't understand why they needed to send this tweet out. Nuno did an interview about it. They sent a tweet out.
Yeah.
And Clattenburg has written a column about it. So I don't... I mean, it seems to sort of render Clattenburg's position pretty useless if the protection for sort of being able to say something detached from the dressing room was the philosophy behind it. And then they do it anyway.
Well, the first thing is... I have a real soft spot for Forest. Not that that's hugely important, but I used to live a few doors down from there. I used to go there quite a lot as a student. It's a football club that does not deserve to be dragged through the mud in this way. I think it was an absolute disgrace, that tweet. And I think if you think of how, you know, often publicly, you know, Brian Clough would kind of wipe away any, you know, criticism of the referee. He might have said it in private, but in public, he was often at pains to say, we don't blame the referee. You know, we have to look at ourselves. You know, it is outrageous to say what they've said in that tweet. And I think, look, we don't know at this stage how much input Marinakis has had into this. What I will say is, Marinakis does have a history with referees. What I will also say is, if you look at Greek football, for example, if you look at Turkish football this season, if you look at other countries, there is, I'm not saying, you know, England is above, you know, this kind of thing happening, but there is a culture in other countries of covering up your own failures by painting referees as corrupt.
It's populism. It's populism, yes, and that is what is creeping into the game here. And it happened actually around points deduction earlier in the season, where it was dressed up as everybody hates us. The people in suits are trying to bring us down, when actually, really, this is about your own failings. And listen, whether you like the punishments or you don't like the punishments, that's a completely different argument. And that's down to the ham-fisted way that the Premier League have put those punishments together. And the Premier League is all of the clubs, by the way, not men in suits that sit in a dark room and decide the future of football clubs. But the idea of creating this sort of this shadowy organisation, the PGMOL, that are trying to bring us down, just sort of causes more consternation. It is populism. I wonder if the biggest problem that Nottingham Forest have right now is not decisions not going their way, but the fact that Nuno Espirito Santo has bought and insists on picking a not very good goalkeeper.
Yeah. Well, they've got a habit, haven't they, of picking not very good goalkeepers, because they've not really replaced Dean Henderson. You know, Matt Turner, I think, is not good enough to be a Premier League number one. You're right about Matt Selbs. I think the first goal, he's got to get there. You know, the shots come from so far out. It wasn't struck particularly well. He has to save it. And as you probably did, Sam, because I know we were talking after the United game and we wanted to see the incidents. Having watched them back last night, I'm not convinced they're that bad a call. The first penalty, I think he dives. I don't think that's a clear penalty. The second one, I guess under the current interpretation, you can say, yes, that's handball, but I didn't think the Wan-Bissaka one was handball at Wembley on Sunday.
But it's close proximity, right? So it's only about a yard. So, and he's turning as he does it. So it's very close, and you can understand why that hasn't been given. If it had been given, I could also understand it on the basis that I've seen them given over the course of the season. But it's not making me pull my hair out because I think it's so blatant. I go back to Saturday night and the handball that should have been given against Jack Grealish. I think that's more blatant. I think that's more clearly and obviously a penalty than the one that is Ashley Young apparently got away with. I think it's more of a penalty than the Jack Grealish one is more of a penalty than the Wan-Bissaka one to Wembley on Sunday afternoon. But the issue here is that the third one is a clear penalty, And yes. What I don't understand is how the referee says he got the ball, and then you can see on the replay that he didn't get the ball, and no one does anything about it, because that is the definition of clear and obvious crook.
Yeah, agreed. But I just wonder if the muddled thinking over the first two appeals, which were very vociferous from a Forest perspective, has that got in the head of the VAR? You know, was it just too hectic? I don't know. I think we'll get an explanation from Howard Webb and from the PGMOL. But what I'm saying is the three decisions, certainly the first two taken in isolation, aren't wrong enough calls to warrant such an angrily worded statement from Forrest. This to me is something that's been bubbling under for some time. The fact that Mark Clattenburg allegedly has felt the need to speak to Howard Webb about the fact that Stuart Atwell has been appointed and he has Luton Town connections. I think Forrest have built themselves up for decisions to go against them, and that statement was probably almost pre-prepared.
Kev, before I ask you the next question, I think it's worth pointing out that the fact that he is a Luton Town fan probably is irrelevant, on the basis that if he was a Luton Town fan, he'd probably want a draw in the game, not Everton to win. He certainly wouldn't want Everton to win, because they've got to play Everton next, and that's a possible six-pointer. So out of anything, he probably wants Nottingham Forest to win, so that when they play Everton, they can drag them into the relegation mire. I don't understand it. That, you know, the sort of Luton Town narrative that he was somehow trying to gain an advantage for the Hatters seems a bit sort of muddled in itself, because actually, it would have been better if Forrest had won the game, Kev.
It's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. And you have to, you know, you have to come to a point in your sport, whether you trust the officials or not. Now, I think the third penalty is a stonewall penalty.
Yes.
It kind of doesn't matter. It kind of doesn't matter, because you have to separate what you believe to be a failure of refereeing from going as far as to say these referees are corrupt. Why? Who benefits? Who benefits? Who? If there's a shadowy conspiracy, who's trying to get Everton relegated? Who's trying to get Nottingham Forest relegated? Nobody cares. It's not, you know, we're not talking kind of, you know, hushed corners where people are passing envelopes and having kind of, you know, these extraordinary conversations about
Richard
getting
Forest
Masters, relegated.
Lord Treesman, Richard Scudamore, I don't know. Somebody
it's
else.
Madness.
They're all
it's
sitting
nonsense.
In a corner in a men's club in West London deciding who really gets relegated when a puff of white smoke comes out of a big fat cigar. And they've decided it's going to be Everton. They're going to stay up. Quick, make it corrupt.
It's
I mean, John Percy, actually, who is a very well-respected journalist for The Telegraph, says the narrative will be that Forrest are mad and the statement is over the top. But the club are raging, and this has happened way too many times. Forget the corruption angle. It is just total incompetence. And obviously not for just Forrest this season. The PGMOL have to get a handle on this. I read another unbelievably detailed Twitter thread last night, which was sort of motivated by the Coventry City offside. I mean, look, we didn't talk about it when we were talking about the game, because we talked so much about Manchester United. But that moment where Victor Torp scores what could have been one of the greatest ever moments in FA Cup history, you know, has been taken away by the tiniest, smallest margin, which even when you look at the stills several hours later, you still can't really determine is guaranteed to be offside. And I read this thread about frame rates, the speed of the camera lenses, the pixelation of the boot and all that kind of stuff that could sort of influence the decision one way or the other. And one of the key points in this thread that I was reading was about the immediacy of a decision making. And actually, when it comes to scoring a goal, for example, I do think actually that you should have to make a decision in the moment. If you think as a linesman that there is a possibility of it being offside, you have to flag straight away. You have to, because you should never have a football match where a game is in the balance like it was on Sunday afternoon at Wembley. Someone scores a dramatic winning goal. The whole place erupts. Half of the Manchester United fans leave. And then all of a sudden, 2 minutes later, someone says, hold on a second. I'm not necessarily sure that is going to count. I think if you believe that there's a possibility that might be offside, you have to flag straight away. So everybody in the stadium, everybody watching, everybody there knows that's going to go to review. I don't think...
But are you going to whistle dead a load of stuff that's then onside? That's the problem. Yeah. If you've got a dude that's through and he's clean through, and we see this all the time, you know, you'll see somebody flag and it's like, mate, he's half a yard on.
Doesn't matter. The whistle is the arbiter, right? So the whistle is the arbiter, not the flag.
Yeah.
So if you flag...
totally kill the joy, because every goal will be flagged offside. Every goal will be checked for offside because they'll be in a state of...
But every goal is checked for offside anyway. Every goal is checked for offside anyway.
But nobody will celebrate. If the offside flag comes out every time, no one's going to have that moment of elation.
Well, no one's going to have that moment of elation anymore anyway, because everybody has now got it in the back of their head that if your goal like that can be turned down in stoppage time, in extra time, in a cup semi-final, any goal can be, any tight offence. Everyone's going to be reluctant to celebrate. I think it was a joy killer on Sunday afternoon. There's no doubt about it. The system doesn't work. For whatever. but if you're a Manchester United fan who left because you thought you just lost the semi-final, got outside and realised it had gone to penalties, it's pretty much a joy killer for you as well.
Do you know what? The only reason we didn't leave at that moment, because again, I got my coat on, I said to the kids, right, come on, we're off now, because we were parked in the same car park as the Cov fans. And I thought, right, this is a good chance to get out early. And my daughter looked at me with puppy dog eyes and she said, but we're seeing Uncle Sam afterwards. I was like, oh, for goodness sake, I've got to stay now.
Sheffield United haven't won at Bramall Lane in 2024. And they're coming forward with Lorenz Asignol down this right-hand side, right-hand corner of the area, trying to skip away from Brereton Diaz. Gets away and scores a brilliant goal! 2-0 to Burnley!
On the cusp of half-time, Luton 0, Brentford 2, Johan Visser at the double. It's his second, and who needs Ivan Toney?
Asignol's coming in field, he's going to go for goal again. Slides it into Foster, 3-1! And the Burnley fans in that Bramall Lane lower tier, loving it!
2 in 3 minutes for Brentford. It's Luton 0, Brentford 4. The goals are flowing now for the Bees, with their fans singing, we are staying up, and they certainly are.
Now Goodmanson! Oh, within 10 seconds of coming on, he's got a fourth for Burnley. And Burnley are within striking distance of those above the relegation dotted line.
Luton 1, Brentford 5. The narrative at the end is they look doomed now, possibly to go down.
But Arsenal are not giving up the title challenge without a fight. Odegaard again scores. The captain finishes it off. And Arsenal are back on top of the Premier League table. And there really is life in the Premier League title race yet. Wolves 0, Arsenal 2.
Good news for Arsenal and good news for Liverpool this weekend. Both of them winning their games. A goal from Trossard, late effort from Odegaard, securing victory at Molineux for Arsenal. Even if there have been concerns over a congested fixture list, Arteta not happy about that. A bit like Pep Guardiola, it looks like those two have been on the phone to one another this week. He was saying, it's not about Pep, it's not about myself, it's about the well-being of our players. We only had 48 hours after flying back from Munich to get the game done. I think they all have a point here. I mean, I'm not usually one for sort of subscribing to the narrative of being tired, but actually, this does seem a little bit odd that both of them played on Saturday after big Champions League games on Wednesday. Crook?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I don't understand why there isn't more thought put into the fixtures. You look, for example, at, I know my temptation is always to look at other countries, but I will look at France, for example. And France went, right, all of our teams that are in the quarterfinals, they get a weekend off. And they just scheduled it for the next midweek. Now, I know that kind of stuff can't always happen, but I just feel like that just wouldn't happen in England necessarily.
There's not the room in the calendar to do that in England, but I also thought it was interesting.
Much.
Real Madrid's game next week, for example, was supposed to be on Saturday night. I was supposed to be doing it for ITV4. And I got a phone call on Saturday morning saying, are you available if that fixture gets moved to Friday night? And I was like, I can't do Friday night. And they were like, well, they've moved the game. You know, at 6 days' notice, they've moved the game to Friday night. Now, our fans would kick off massively about that because travel plans have been made. But because of the nature of Spanish football, slightly different, they don't travel away from home very often. There's not many fans from the opposing club that go to away games, right? So you don't have that sort of tribal nature of fans having to get you know, all together, getting on coaches, getting on trains, etc. So the transport issue is not as big. They can change it with short notice. We can't do that here. So I don't know what the solution is, Kev.
No, and La Liga fans will tell you that scheduling in La Liga is something quite unique, because they will just sort out, you know, schedules really tight to time, yeah. As I'm sure, as somebody who commentates on La Liga, you'll well know by now.
Yeah, but it's crazy.
I just think there needs to be more communication in general. And I think you're absolutely right about fans as well. The powers that be, unfortunately, in our country, don't care about travelling fans, because if they did, they would have far more of a thought about when games are scheduled. They'd be far stronger with the broadcasters. And I understand the broadcasters give a load of money. I get that. I work for some of the broadcasters, so I get it. But I wish they were a little bit more open to fans' needs as well. So I just think in general, these things being kind of given as a fait accompli, and it's like, right, this is your fixture, this is when you play, and blah, blah, blah. It would be nice if there was just at least a feeling of more collaboration and more thought about how this works out.
It's a difficult situation though, Kev, because if the broadcasters pay basically every single penny that they've got possible, saved down the back of a sofa, they're literally scrambling for every penny, hundreds and hundreds of million pounds, everything they've got to pile into these fixtures, they want to maximise the value from them in order to try and recoup that revenue. And if you start playing fixtures at 9 o'clock on a Saturday night every week, they're not going to recoup that money, because that's not a great televisual experience for the football fan. Not as many people are going to watch that. So you get yourself into a sort of quandary. Do we give the power to the football clubs to put the fixtures where they want them to be, and therefore reduce the TV audience, and over time then therefore reduce the TV contracts, therefore reduce the wages? It has a spiraling effect. Or do you leave it to the broadcasters, who get more power to dictate, invest more money, and then it continues in that vein? It's a difficult situation, but football's got itself into this situation because it's demanded more and wants more money. Just a quick word on Wolverhampton Wanderers, 6 games now without a win in all competitions. Jeff Shee saying that the club didn't bring in any reinforcements in January because they were worried about PSR. Gary O'Neill actually, I think, sort of felt as if he was talking from a position of strength when he didn't criticise that, but sort of started to just poke the bear about getting reinforcements in the summer. Will he be able to, Crook, do you think?
Well, I think they're going to have to sell. I think Pedro Neto probably is the most likely to be snapped up by a bigger club, but I think you'd be a little bit worried about his hamstring and his injury record. I think Ryan Aitnori actually is one to keep an eye on. There are clubs, not just in this country, but in Europe as well, who are monitoring his progress. I think he was on PSG's list already. So I think they'll probably make one big sell in the summer, and that'll allow Gary to strengthen the squad. I think they need a number nine to come in, because Cunha's a good player, but he's not really that out-and-out goal scorer. I think it'll be an interesting summer for Wolves. But I guess if you are Jeff Shee, you probably feel a little bit aggrieved that Wolves did what they had to last summer in terms of selling players. And obviously it cost them Lopetegui, although he looks a little bit foolish now, whereas other clubs clearly haven't done that. And they're being punished by points deductions. Wolves have tried to do it the right way. And I think, again, that just really gives credit to Gary O'Neill for the fact he's not only managed to stabilise them in the Premier League, but actually at one stage they were looking at Europe. That probably won't happen now, but they've had a great season anyway.
I think Wolves did the right thing. I think, you know, they didn't break the rules. They made sure they stayed within the rules, and they haven't been deducting points as a result of that. So, you know, and they're very secure in the Premier League because they've hired a good manager who's done a very good job. Kev, we have run over spectacularly, but I am going to give you 30 seconds to talk about Fulham 1, Liverpool 3. Liverpool bouncing back after their exit to Atalanta in the Europa League. Did this look like a team that had been given a kick up the backside?
A little bit. I think that started with the win in Bergamo against Atalanta. I think that process started then. But again, they look more clinical, and they did deserve to win the game. I thought Fulham caused them problems here and there, but I thought generally Liverpool looked good. I think one of the most encouraging things actually was Cody Gakpo. I think he'd had a little bit of a slump in recent weeks. I thought he looked really sharp actually and played very well. Great that Jota scored. And it shows the depth that Liverpool have in attack, that you could not have Nunez, not have Salah in the starting 11 and still look really dangerous. But they've got five games they have to win if they're to have any chance of winning the league. But big positive step in the right direction.
At the bottom of the table, Burnley have four games, then probably have to win them all. They beat Sheffield United by 4-1. They are not officially down yet, but will be if Nottingham Forest get 3 points and they don't the next time those two play at the same time. So I think that'd be Saturday of next week. Brentford 5-1. Bad performance from Luton Town. Luton, though, still in with a chance because Nottingham Forest defeat against Everton gave them that. So I really think that's probably between Forest, Luton and Burnley to fight to stay in the Premier League. Burnley would be some story if they managed to pull it off. Luton would be some story if they managed to pull it off. And it would be some story if Nottingham Forest went down. But we will see between now and the end of the season. There may well be a twist in that race because there's only 1 point separating those two, although Nottingham Forest's goal difference is much, much better. Kevin, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Crookie, thank you very much as well. Please tell all your friends about the Premier League All Access podcast. Right, that's it from us. We'll be back for a preview to all the weekend's action on Friday morning.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. The latest odds? We set them. Form guides? We've got them. Expert opinions? We share them. The best fans in the world deserve the best. Be match day ready before the whistle blows with Ladbrokes. Odds update on Talk Sport with Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com. 18 plus. Be gambleaware.org. T's and C's apply.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.